And now it's time for wait a minute. What the hell is the show called again?
It's Chatter on Books. What else do you want me to say? Can I go now?
That's right. It's Chatter on Books. Let's do this thing.
Yes, Tony, you can go. But thank you for letting us use the studios here at Chatter. We are back for episode number 4 of Chatter on Books.
Who thought we would make it to 4? Jamie didn't.
I made it to 4. 1 and 4. That's why I made it. Skip the other one.
Well, now it's 2 and 4.
Yes.
2 and 4. You're batting 500.
Which would
if
be
you could bat 500 in baseball, you'd be in the Hall of Fame.
That's right. Yeah.
So, yes, we are here with pretty much our regular crew. Gina McManus back in studio. Jamie McIntyre, and our fearless leader, Tori Clark.
Great to be here. And David Aldridge was going to be here,
yes.
But I got a very mysterious text from him today saying there's something very important that I need to do tonight in the sports world, because he's now the managing poobah of all things important at The Athletic. So it'll be really interesting to see what happens.
So that sounds like a story is breaking.
It sounds like a wizard story to me.
It does sound like a wizard story.
It's the only thing going on.
It's not a cap story. It's got to be a wizard story. Okay.
Yes.
But I also, we're here at the corner of Wisconsin and Jennifer Streets, Northwest.
I have to do something. I'm sorry to interrupt this. I have to close the window because we're going to get feedback. Because I have to turn the volume up so loud. We're going to get feedback.
Gotcha.
So I got to.
We
close
like
that.
You, but okay. We're shutting the door on you.
Okay.
Yeah.
Don't take it personally.
There we go. Sorry.
But I like the ambient noise in the background. Maybe we can just fake the ambient noise in the
background.
Have Brian come in.
The roar of the crowd.
So this is the fourth episode of Chatter on Books at the corner of Jennifer and Wisconsin Streets Northwest.
The fourth and best.
It has rained every single time.
I'm sick of this.
Yeah.
I totally sick.
Nice of you, Jeannie, to take that rain to the West Coast for Thanksgiving.
I went to San Francisco for Thanksgiving. I arrived on Tuesday. The city was blanketed with smoke. I brought the rain. Wednesday it poured rain. It cleared the smoke right out. Thursday was okay. Friday it poured rain. It cleared the smoke right out. When I left, air conditions were green. Thank you very much.
Congratulations. Yes. Nice job. Nice job.
Did what I could.
Can you fix the earthquake problem out there, too?
We sat around and decided, would we rather die by fire, earthquake, tsunami, or mudslide?
All options in California
all
now.
Options.
Some
all
say
options.
The world should end in fire. Some say ice.
John McCain used to always have the joke, being from Arizona, he used to always say, you know, hang around in Arizona long enough because pretty soon it's going to be shorefront property. You can have beachfront property. All right. It is great to be here. A little bit later, we're going to be joined by Sarah Pekkanen, who is a local gal. I'm allowed to say gal, I guess. A local gal.
You can.
Who has sold kabillions and billions of books. One of the things I'm fascinated with is she wrote 7 very successful books in 7 years.
Wow.
We're going to be talking a lot about The Wife Between Us, which is her latest book, which she actually co-authored with someone named Greer Hendricks. I'm fascinated how you could possibly co-author something.
Me too. Hard enough
to write a book, period, much less with somebody. But we've got a couple of housekeeping things on top. And the first one is we have, as she is well known in the Tony Kornheiser land, cool Aunt Claire. I would say cool Aunt Claire.
Yes, Claire.
Aunt Claire. Who has started for us on Facebook. It is called...
I think it's actually The Facebook.
It's The Facebook. And she has started the Chatter on Books podcast fan community.
Oh, wow. Look at
that.
If
you go to Facebook...
Thank you, Claire.
Claire did what I asked several of my 20-something children to do, none of which managed to get that done.
Well, because kids don't use Facebook anymore.
I know. They certainly don't use The Facebook. Yes. They're onto things I haven't even heard of. Right?
Yeah.
I was kind of keeping up with them, Instagram, Snapchat, etc. And now there are things... Finsta? Mark, do you know Finsta? You're the youngest
one
in the room.
Yeah, okay.
Wasn't he
so
on
I'm
the Munsters?
That's what I thought. It's like a very small, very tight community, your closest pals, these kinds of things.
Finsta,
which nobody
called?
Else can say. Yeah. Hello there. Now we're welcomed by Sarah. Hello,
oh,
Sarah.
This,
we were
Sarah.
Just saying really nice things about you. Welcome.
Oh, yeah. Well, don't let me stop you. Please continue.
We
welcome.
Most importantly,
well, we actually run out. We had a list and we got to the bottom and there was
yeah,
no
we had
no
very
place
short
to
list.
That.
Just on a little post-it.
And most importantly, somebody got you a drink already.
Oh, I have my priorities firmly in line. I have a drink.
Well
they
done.
Had a great list.
Excellent.
So, yeah, happy to be here.
Great to have you. So we're glad. Thank you so much, Claire, for doing that. And we have some news tonight about Simon the Sea Cat.
Oh, yes. That's right. Simon the Sea Cat is now available in paperback on Amazon. So if you look it up.
Yay.
Yes, it's very. I was excited when it was available on Kindle. But people are like, I want a copy in my hands.
Yeah, it's and a I'm gift like, book, Mark.
Yes, it really is. Yeah. It is. Well, what I recommend is to buy both versions.
There
and then
go.
The eventual audiobook, which I'll be getting together
sometime
soon.
If one bought
soon.
Both versions, would then one get a discount on the plush toy that I'm going to be responsible for?
No, everything is full charge. This is, as Tony would say, this is a for-profit business. And I'm not nearly as rich as Tony, so. But no, I've had some enormously wonderful feedback from people that have read it, and just awfully kind things from a number of people. And this today, even though it was really finished a while ago, this feels like the moment where it's done.
Finally, oh, yeah.
That's I heard it was such a hot gift for Christmas that they're making a sequel to that Arnold Schwarzenegger movie where he has to get the special
Jingle
gift.
All the Way.
Jingle All the Way.
Now it's
part two.
I need to get that book with the cat in it.
Exactly.
Where is it? Get it to me now. So I'm very, very happy. And I have to thank two people. One, Allison Fligg, who helped me with all the graphic design because I couldn't figure it out to get the cover set for it. So, Allison, thank you for that. And my mom, who has been the biggest cheerleader in this project that you could ever hope for. So, thanks, Mom.
How nice.
Brian's yeah. here.
Hey, Brian.
Brian's
and thank,
here.
And thank you, Brian.
Brian. Yeah, by the way, I think 1,000 years ago when you first thought of this idea and all your smart friends were telling you, don't do that, it's a waste of time. I think yours truly said, no, you have to do this.
No, you did. Yeah,
it's
you. Yeah,
you. There's a cat book in you dying to get out.
It is.
God help us.
Release it. So.
And the
God
plush toy is a great idea.
The plush toy.
It's Garfield.
Oh,
yeah.
It is a great idea. And I think, Jeannie, you were saying we got to get it as a hardcover. And I want to do that because I see this as, I mean, it really would be a cool. But
and then the movie.
And then yeah. the movie.
But let's not get out ahead of our skis.
No, yeah. The sequel, Simon the Sea Cat Goes Skiing.
Well, he's only got one story. But this is a line of books I want to write about. There's all these great stories of animals in history doing like these amazing things. And I love history and I love animals. So it's a good combo
Yay.
For me.
Congratulations.
So thank you. Thank you very much.
And then when the Illumination people do the animation, they'll have to stretch the whole thing out to like 2.5 hours.
Oh, yeah. Well, it'll be
lots of gags.
Yeah.
Easily done.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Easily
done. We saw the trailers for Lion King. We'll do a live action thing for this. It'll be fantastic.
All right. Now, normally we would be talking about the best and worst of the bestsellers list, but as we've learned in the first 3 episodes of our podcast here, some things don't change that much. Somewhat scarily, Mark, your buddy Tucker's book continues to move up.
Ship
it
of
continues
fools.
To move up. So you have to read it.
I was at a house.
I know. I really do need to read it.
Thanksgiving, and that book was on the coffee table.
Really?
I almost
to provoke people?
I almost picked it up.
Can I say something about the bestseller list? And Sarah, I'm sure, is going to be interested in this.
It's the only person we know who's been on it.
Because she's writing fiction. And there's a great column every week in the New York Times Book Review, Inside the List, by Tina Jordan. And she writes this week that fiction is on the downside, that nonfiction is selling much better than fiction. And she adds, case in point, this week's hardcover fiction list, every single author with a new book on it is a big-name franchise. Lee Child, Leanne Moriarty, Richard Paul Evans, Mary Higgins Clark, Clive Cussler, Jeffrey Archer, and Alexander McCall Smith. These are people that just keep dominating that list. And so it must be extremely hard for new fiction writers to break through, especially because fiction is out, nonfiction is out.
Yeah. So, Sarah, we'll go back and forth, but let's introduce Sarah a little bit. Local gal from New York, right? From New York.
I was born in New York, but I've lived in Maryland most of my life.
But that's the Chevy Chase
took
right
a 5-minute
up the street.
Uber to get here. Yeah.
Excellent. Excellent. And I was saying earlier before the show, one of the things that just stuns us, 7 books in 7 years. Most people never write one book in their entire life.
It's actually now 9 books in 8 years.
Good Lord.
God. Yeah.
Does that mean you're slacking off or going faster? I think that means you're going faster.
I think it means I'm drinking more wine, but I'm not sure.
And you're a recovering journalist?
I am, yeah. I wanted to be an author when I was a kid, so I would write my stories like miscellaneous tales and poems, send them off to publishers. Shockingly, got rejected. I don't know how that happened.
So but you're a little kid. I read that and I thought, oh my gosh, so you're a little, how do you even know where to write a letter? How did you know how to find a publisher?
Yeah, we didn't have Google then, so I don't know what happened. I probably looked in the back of my Nancy Drew book and found the, Simon and Schuster on, whatever street. And
Dear
and
sir
and
madam, will you read my book? Took me years
much.
To write. Will you take a
Good
look?
Yeah.
Just for the record, I'd like to say that while I haven't written a book, I've written a couple of book proposals.
And did they even respond?
Well, no, they were so lame, I was afraid to send them in.
The first draft is so horrifying.
I'm sure.
My entire first book still lives in my nightstand, where I live in fear of somebody finding it, because it is so bad.
Is it in print still?
What's that?
Is it in print?
Oh, no. It was never in print. It got soundly rejected by every publisher in New York. Yeah. Yeah. Which was a good thing. But the second one did get published, so...
So when I was at CNN, we had this producer, one of the producers of one of the talk shows on the weekend, and he was an aspiring author, and he said he's going to leave and write a book, and we thought, oh, he's not going to succeed, and so Dan Silva's doing quite well.
Oh,
wow. He's one of those dominating the bestseller list,
exactly.
Right? Making hard for the newbies.
It must be depressing.
Well, you know, I never hit the list until I changed from my standalone kind of beach reads, commercial women's fiction, into psychological thrillers that I now co-write. And so that one actually hit the list. We didn't know what number it was going to come in on, but we did know it would hit the list because the person who writes that column called our editor for a quote about our book. But the question was it going to be number 15? Was it going to be higher? And so they told us at our publishing house, they got the list, they covered it up, and they started reading it from 15 up. And when they got close to the top, apparently there was a lot of anxiety that there was some mistake and we weren't on it. But then they read number 2, and we hit it number 2,
wow.
Hardcover and E combined. And we're thrilled.
So I think Tori and I want to know how you co-write a book.
Yeah.
And she was your editor for many years.
She was
Greer
my
Hendricks,
editor, yeah. Simon & Schuster. So how we do it, there are kind of two components that go on. One is the personality, and the other is kind of the mechanics. And we got along just terrifically well. She began to edit my books. I sold my first book to her in 2008. And we had a lot of weird similarities. Exact same age. We were terrible cooks. We both had brothers that we were close to, older brothers, both named Robert. We just
both
had,
played field hockey. Did I read that?
Both played field hockey. Minored in psychology.
What position?
Yeah, what
I was
position?
A link. So I was in the middle between the offense and defense.
Okay.
Ran around a lot.
Okay.
Yeah. So we really hit it off, and we would start to have these long dinners in New York, and you know, every time I went there, talk. But when it came time for us to write a book, when she left Simon & Schuster, and I said, I'm ready to try something a little different, but doing a lot of beach reads, I want to do a psychological thriller like Gone Girl, it was, how do we do it? You're in New York, I'm here. So luckily we have teenagers who know a lot more about electronics and you know, all of that than we do. And they said, you know, there's this thing called Google Docs and Google Hangouts,
right.
Which was revolutionary to us, but we are looking at the same screen in real time in our separate cities. We're on a phone call over the computer, talking, writing, editing in a weird twin language where we're both going into the document, we're both changing, we're both typing, we're talking in shorthand. We need to actually, I think, film it because we're so in sync that we call it one brain at this point. And it's working. I mean, we're on our third book together. We're... whatever it is, we don't analyze
it. But does
it.
One of you structure the plot and one of you develop the characters, or it's just
we're on the phone
organic.
six, 8 hours a day, every day. When it comes time to write a new book, we're on our third, we talk about the plot endlessly. We talk and talk and talk. What if is one of our favorite expressions.
So do you know how the book's going to end when you first start writing it, or do you just
We think we
it
do,
out?
And we're usually quite wrong. Yeah.
And do you have an editor who now edits both of you?
We have a terrific editor. Really? Yeah, Jen Enderlin, St. Martin's Press. She's the editor and publisher. And, you know, she edits us and edits us beautifully.
And how does your partner, Greer Hendricks, respond to an editor?
Well, you know.
Yeah, that's a good question because
right.
I'm a former editor.
Well,
yeah.
A lot of people think like it's kind of combative, right, that there's going to be some fight between writers and editors. And that's why they're shocked to learn that Greer and I have never had a fight. And our editor, we look at it like you're trying to make our book better.
That's
you're
right.
Like a top soccer coach coaching our kid, giving him tips. You know, maybe we don't agree with every single thing, but with Jen, we agree with like 99% of her, you know, her edits. And you kind of take your ego out because Greer and I mean, occasionally we'll be writing something and I'll write a line and I'll be like, that was the dumbest line anybody's ever written. We will not speak of this again. We'll crack up. We'll go on. You just get your ego out of it. And it's all about the book.
So my entire experience with an editor when many years ago I left the Pentagon doing some different things, need to make some money, and this great guy Bob Burnett says, oh, you got to write a book, because that's what hacks from Washington do, right? So the book became Lipstick on a Pig. And I was pretty excited because we sold it to Simon & Schuster, and I go up there and they introduced me to this great guy, Dominic Anfuso, who was a famous editor at the time. He said to me, great, I've never had an editor in my entire life, and I've always thought I needed one. So I thought, this is going to be a fantastic experience. So I start cranking out just drivel, and I would send him stuff and wouldn't get much back. He was an absolutely delightful guy and would never get anything back. And then meanwhile, the people who actually put the books together and have to sell it are sending me all these deadlines saying, we need this, we need this. And I go, yeah, but I'm getting nothing back from Dominic. But I didn't want to say anything because I was so appreciative and I had already spent the advance. I was gone. And so I would just keep sending him stuff and get nothing back and nothing back. And so it's the end of a summer and they're saying, you need to have this whole thing turned in, say, September 1. I'm like, holy cow. So I called. And I got him on the phone. I said, look, I really need your help on this.
Uh-oh.
Because I can tell stories. I can talk, but I don't write well. And I really need your help on this. And he goes, got it. I've been really busy, but I'm sure it was to the Hamptons. He says, I'm going to the Hamptons. I've got plenty of time. He says, send me your latest draft. This is going to be my number one priority. And the idiot that I am, I believed him. So I sent it off, and this is when you sent your manuscript off in FedEx package.
I hope he's not listening to this.
I hope he is. I will never forgive him for this. And so maybe 5 days later, big, heavy FedEx package on my front porch.
Uh-oh.
It's from the Hamptons, and I'm really excited, and I take it out. And the first couple of pages in red, his edits, and they were really good. And I thought, this is what it's like. This is fabulous. Second page, third page, this is great. And I got to page 4, nothing. Oh, well, he liked page 4. Page 5, nothing. He did the first 3 pages, and that was it.
So, you know, there's...
Well, that's enough, right?
Yeah, exactly.
There's
I was supposed to learn from that.
There's an absolutely classic joke about the relationship between writers and editors. I'll try to tell it really, really fast. So the writer and the editor are stranded in the desert. They're dying of thirst, and they're crawling across the hot desert sand, and they see an oasis in the distance, and they manage to make it there. And they're not sure if it's a mirage, but when they get there, sure enough, it's this crystal clear sylvan pool of cool water. And they jump in, and they're so excited. They're pouring the water over themselves, and they're drinking the water. And then suddenly the editor gets out, stands on the side of the oasis, and begins to relieve himself into the oasis. And the writer says, what are you doing? And he says, I'm making it better.
Oh. Now, on behalf of editors.
Yeah. So that's, what kind of editor are you, Jeannie?
Well, I would say...
The best.
That I was an editor who allowed writers to have a voice. Mm-hmm. And working at a daily newspaper, they couldn't have a voice if they were writing a news story. But I worked with a lot of columnists, Tony Kornheiser, Michael Wilbon, Thomas Boswell, great sports columnists. And they had a voice, and I tried to stay out of the way. And Tom Shales I worked with as well, in style, but I would say that in general, the better the writer, the more they valued editing. The more insecure a writer, the less mm-hmm. they valued
yeah.
editing.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I get that. I understand.
Yeah.
It didn't mean that I let them have their way. You know,
you let them think they were having their way.
Imposed my will on yeah. their copy, but. It was a clear demarcation
uh-huh.
for me.
Sarah, were you a good writer when you were a child? What did you want? Do you want to be a writer when you were growing up?
Again, I'm bringing you back to Miscellaneous Tales and Poems.
Yeah.
I think that titles were clearly not my strength. I'm not sure I'd say I was a good writer. My dad always said my stories had a sense of beginning, middle, and end.
I read that he was a medical writer.
He was a medical
writer, true?
Yeah.
So he had
yeah.
to be very precise.
Very precise, but he did narrative. So he did storytelling, the stories behind. Like when Reagan was shot, what was it like for all the doctors?
We were talking about that before.
Yeah. Really?
Yes.
Yeah, we were talking about the Reagan.
Yeah, 6 degrees. Okay. So what was it like for the doctors who operated on him? Like that kind of human interest story. So, you know, I joke with my mom one day. She said, you know, you always said you wanted to be like Dad. And I thought, well, you know, Dad hangs out in the basement and he gets to write in sweatpants and not shower for 2 days. So I brought you to my office one day when I was all dressed up and, you know, working away. And I said, now, don't you want to be like Mom? And you said, no, I want to sit in my sweatpants in the basement like Dad all day. That looks like a more fun job.
Yeah.
But I don't know if it's genetic or if it's learned, you know, watching his love of storytelling that infused me. But yeah, it was what I always wanted to do.
Excellent. What was it? Journalism? The lifestyle didn't work for you, correct?
Yeah, when I had kids. Yeah. I mean, I did a lot of narratives. I mean, it was everything from, one of them's out there eating dessert. He better save me a piece or else. I did a lot of narratives. So it was like, similar to what my dad did with medical, but with a different twist. I didn't have that expertise. But like during the Columbine shootings, I went out immediately, did a story of a kid who was an unlikely hero. Things like that. So I, for the Baltimore Sun, learned to tell stories kind of on a broader scale. They were longer. I was given a little more room. But then when I had kids, I left journalism and I just missed it so much. I was, for the first time, not writing. So I brought a glass of wine up to my room one night when my kids were asleep, which they never slept. But during a rare hour when they were napping, I started trying to write a book. And 5 years later, it turned into that book that every publisher in New York turned down. But then I wrote another one. And I had to, get little pockets of time wherever I could. So I would take my kids to Chuck E. Cheese, and I would have a system where I would buy tokens, put them on my table, have my laptop, have an eye at the exit, and say, come up to me for every token. Because that way I could type a line, I could get a visual, I'd be like, you're okay, type a line.
Maryland Chuck E. Cheese or Virginia Chuck E. Cheese?
Maryland.
Here's the problem. With somebody who my husband Brian raised 3 kids around here, and if your child got invited to a Maryland Chuck E. Cheese birthday party, or your child wanted to have their birthday party at a Maryland Chuck E. Cheese, you died. Versus Virginia, because in Virginia they serve beer at Chuck E. Cheese.
Oh, they changed it, and they did serve in Maryland. That went into my writing calculation.
Excellent.
So maybe it was before. Yeah,
there you go.
It was
excellent.
Later. Maybe they wanted to be known as attracting writers, and they needed to serve alcohol.
Well, you talk about trying to find time at Chuck E. Cheese and doling out tokens. You said this line to me, Tori, when we're talking about, I was trying to write a very small book. And you're like, it's difficult when you're trying to do it in the margins of your life.
Yeah.
Because you have the rest of your life. And you see these writers, and it's like, that's their gig. And I mean, this is what you do. So it's like, okay, this is how my whole world is set up. But when you've got all these other things you're juggling, it's so hard to find time to write one line.
Well, because you hear people about writer's block. And of course, I've had this, like, you're typing, and it's like, it's the best of times, it's the worst of times. And then you're like,
the worst of times.
Then you're backspacing over. And then you're just like, you can do that for an hour, and you have nothing on the page.
Yeah.
Ishmael, then you can't go anywhere after that.
Exactly.
Like, wow, it never gets that good.
Yeah.
But I do have a theory about that. I think that when you actually have more going on, sometimes it's easier to write because you don't have time to think yourself out of it. Like, when I have a long stretch of time, it's like, oh, the laundry's calling to me or this or that or whatever it is. When I have an hour, I'm like, I'm just going to turn on the gas because we tend to really criticize ourselves as writers. We'll write that line, backspace, this is horrible. Does, the Oxford comma, are we using that or not? Like, we kind of can go down a lot of rabbit holes. But when you have an hour, I'm going to turn on the gas. I'm going to throw it down. It's only an hour. It's like, who's going to expect this to be good?
Right.
You can actually get a lot done, right?
Yeah.
Well, I find that to be true because I write I don't want to have an ad here, but I write a daily newsletter on defense and national security.
What's it called?
It's called Jamie McIntyre's Daily on Defense. I didn't name it. The Washington Examiner named it. But the point is, I have today I'm writing a story. It was taking me forever. But in the morning when I write this newsletter, I only have from 4 a.m. to 6:30. It has to go out at 7 o'clock. So I get up at 4 a.m. and it's like you said, it's like I have this much time. I've got to, it's just like, I just, it just pours. It's like, it doesn't have to be good. It just has to get done. And it does. I produce a lot more in that 2 hours than I do the rest of the day.
And sometimes it's good to just throw it out there. And be like, okay, if it's total crap, I can always kill it later, or I can, maybe there's one thing in there that I, a kernel that I can build stuff
or
around.
Or you can just blame your editor.
Or you blame the editor.
Don't do that.
But I mean, but
I ask that you don't do that.
But the hardest part is just to get it out on paper.
Absolutely. The first draft should be ugly. I'm a big fan of the
ugly,
horrible, let it all just ramble, and then you go back. It's like you're throwing a bunch of clay down on a pottery wheel. You can shape it later. You can make it pretty, but you got to throw that clay down.
Somebody has that expression. That good writing is writing and rewriting and rewriting and rewriting kind of thing. And I try to say that to my kids all the time, which of course they ignored. Just write something. What's an essay? And then let it sit for a day and then go back. And they go, but I have to do it in the next 10 minutes. That part doesn't really work.
Right.
Doesn't really work. And there's a famous author who got her start sitting in her car at 4 o'clock in the morning. It'll come to me at 3 o'clock in the morning. But she didn't. Same kind of thing. Had a family, but had these ideas.
A lot of them. I mean, David Baldacci would get up before his law firm job and start writing in the morning. John Grisham.
Yeah.
I think a lot of them did because they felt like, you know, I'll get up an hour or two earlier. My brain is clear. I've had that reboot from sleep. I've got coffee. That's the writer's best friend, right?
It's quiet. It's calm.
Yeah.
It's like this.
And you've got
piece.
Those 2 hours, and you just go.
Yeah.
Right? So a
yeah.
lot of writers do that. Early in the morning.
By the way, did I tell you the insanity when I wrote my little... Again, I could do this because it's only 42 pages. I was like 20 pages or whatever. I wrote it
big pictures.
I wrote it longhand. I actually wrote it out longhand like I was, you know,
some
back in 18.
You and
Tony.
Do.
Does Tony do that
too?
Sure. Oh, well, no. He wrote his column on a computer, but his... Notes are
oh,
all
yeah, everything
all his preparations notes.
And then it was horrifying to have to type it. I was like, this is dreadful. Who's ever going to read this?
I don't know if Alan Greenspan still does. It's a different kind of writing. But Alan Greenspan, for a long time, would first thing in the morning, a couple hours in the bathtub with a long yellow legal pad.
I'd be worried he'd misplace a comma and something would happen to the interest rates
the
or something.
But
that whole recession, that was my fault.
Well, it is the case that the longer you work on something, the less you start to believe it's just drivel. It's like, you know, no one would read this.
That's
this
right.
is just drivel.
Well,
because
King
you're
did
so
that
familiar
with
it.
With Carrie. Stephen King threw out, was it Carrie? Yeah, it was Carrie.
Was
he
it
threw
Carrie?
It out. And his wife went and smoothed the pages out from the trash can and was like, hey, you got something here? And so that happens. We don't have perspectives. So
What is the personality of writers like you? You said very self-critical. What else?
It depends. I think a lot of us are part introvert, part extrovert, because you have to do both, right? You have to go on tour and do certain things, but you also need that alone time to kind of recharge.
Mm-hmm.
Sensitive, probably a little too sensitive. What else? I don't know. You guys join in. You guys know.
This is only my first book, so I'm still trying to find myself.
Yeah. So when do you sell the movie rights? That's the big
question. Oh, we have.
Yes. Oh, that's great.
Yeah, no, actually, so The Wife Between Us.
How cool is that?
We sold the movie rights on a partial. We wrote because, I had kind of taken a pause in my solo books. Greer had taken a pause in her career. We wrote a third of it and wrote a synopsis for the rest, and it went out to publishers. And then we didn't want to leak it beyond that because we had a big twist. But apparently there are people in different publishing houses who are scouts who will send it. So we got a call saying DreamWorks is interested. You guys need to, get on the phone. So we did. So they bought the movie rights.
Did you, on the phone, when you're talking to them, did you have to tell them the ending?
Well, they had the synopsis. Mm-hmm. But the crazier thing that happened, so they bought it. But I've had stuff optioned before, not much has happened. So we kind of thought, they bought it. They're not that interested. They're sitting on
Sometimes
it.
Sometimes you just buy them to keep them.
To keep,
just
in case.
But holding.
Right. But it still had to be pretty cool. The first time you're like, somebody wants to make a movie.
And DreamWorks, Amblin.
Yes.
It was actually Amblin.
How cool is that?
So 6 months ago, Greer and I are touring, and we get a call. The president of production of Amblin wants to meet with you guys. And so we're like, well, great. We've been in, a few cities. And so we fly back into LaGuardia. We change in the restroom because there was nowhere else but the airport
restroom.
Which is restroom.
Such a luxurious place.
We are very glamorous.
Yes.
The writing life is very chic.
It's sort of like Penn Station's restroom.
I mean, we're holding up dresses. Is this too wrinkled? Is this wrinkled? So we go, we meet the head of production for Amblin, and she's like, I just want to tell you, I've been interviewing writing teams, because it's usually screenwriters or teams. Nobody's gotten the material right, and I wanted to see if you guys want to pitch it. So we're like, yeah, we'll pitch it, sure, So we leave the meeting, Google, how do you pitch a movie? And write up a 20-minute pitch, and then we get on the phone with her and some other people from Amblin and the producer, who we didn't even know was signed on, and for 20 minutes we spoke with our vision of the movie, and there was silence on the other end of the phone. And we finish, and they're like, okay, great, we'll get back to you. And we thought, okay, well, there we go. And then 10 minutes later, our agent called and said, you have the job. There's a new contract to have the film.
Okay, so this raises two big questions. One of them is, have you thought about writing the screenplay, which is completely different than writing a book? And have you, imagined who would play the character?
Oh, that's Nellie. All we do is we imagine who would play the character. That's much more fun than the writing.
Yeah.
But no, I mean, we are writing the screenplay for Amblin.
I would love to ask you about that, because normally that is, they run from that. They don't want the author of the book writing the screenplay. I remember Chris Buckley sold Thank You for Smoking, which is a fabulous book.
Oh, sure. Very funny movie.
And the screenplay guy calls him up and says, I'm the guy who's going to ruin your book, because that's what the relationship generally is. But they
and they don't want the writer out there, because when it's being made, they're like, no, this is not what I did. What are you doing? All right, somebody get the writer a drink and get them off set now.
Do you have any veto power at all over the...
Oh, come on, we're writer. We got no power. Well, the next book, so An Anonymous Girl, which I'm giving away an arc of, that one has been optioned by E1 for a limited series. They put together Sharp Objects. And they made us executive producers. And we do have in the contract that we have input on key creative decisions. So you
can be a pain in the ass if you want to be.
Yeah, and we may want to. Yeah. We may want to just
throw it around.
M&Ms in our
room. It's very hard to talk about your book, The Wife Between Us, because of spoilers.
Yeah.
So how do you navigate that conversation when you go out? When you're on TV, for example, or radio talking about your book, how hard is that?
It's really, it is really tricky. I have to be very careful in terms of what I say. So we have like our little elevator pitch, just you think you're reading about a woman who is obsessed with her ex-husband's new bride-to-be, her replacement. Think again, but we cannot say much.
Right.
And in writing the screenplay, we've had to have a few talks because they're like, the marketing material. Like, you can't do it this way because we've got to market it this way. So so there's a lot of gymnastics, but we actually like that part of the process because we're taking our book and kind of slicing it up into, different different scenes and rejiggering it to work for film.
The number of words in a screenplay and the number of words in a book, it's like there's a tiny fraction of words that make it into the screenplay.
Yeah, screenplays, so one page is 1 minute. So your max is going to be 120 pages. And the margins are like tiny. And there's a lot of spaces. There's a lot
white space.
Yeah, there's a lot
of... Because the director has to have some idea, some vision to turn this into a movie.
One of the things I wondered about, and then we should get to who you think should play the roles, is because I heard you had sold it, reading it, it took a long time to decide I was in her camp, because I'm reading it going, these are clever people, right? They're going to suck me down a path and then I'll get my little heart broken by this person. And it took me a long time. I'm still not really sure, having read it. The whole thing with the dog, it's just like, don't go there.
Yeah.
But in a movie, you don't have that much time.
Yeah.
In a movie, you don't have that much time, and you have to have winners and losers, and people you root for or people you're rooting against.
And that's subplots.
That's why these limited series are so great. This really is the golden age of television, where you can take something and put it into this limited series of 8 or 6 or episodes, and you can really tell the story.
Yeah, I mean, Big Little Lies did that, right? Yeah. That was like one of the first ones that was hugely successful, Sharp Objects. Now they're doing it more and more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, so give us your vision. Who plays the major roles
in
your movie?
I
and what are you going to wear at the premiere, most importantly?
Oh, that's so important. I don't know. I probably not Old Navy, because that's usually what I have in my closet. But
no, go Old Navy. Go Old Navy.
But I love Naomi Watts.
She'd be good.
Yeah, Leo DiCaprio, his production company, read it. I think there was some interest. I'm not sure what happened, I guess. But I would love him.
Colin Farrell.
Yeah, he would be good.
As Richard?
He's a little dark, isn't he?
He can go dark, good.
And is there a cameo for you? Because I was watching Elf the other night, and I saw that Jon Favreau was
is that
the doctor. Yeah, he's in Elf.
Did he have lines?
Yes.
Nice.
I just want to throw out Gilbert Gottfried. Just
always.
Just,
right.
Yeah, he always. Is
I rep
leading
him,
man.
So I want to make sure he gets.
Isn't he going to be the voice of Simon the Sea Cat when the animated movie comes out?
Right. No.
Who would play Maureen?
Maureen.
Catherine Keener.
Oh, good call.
I love her.
You thought about
She'd be
this.
Great.
How did
Maureen.
You think of that? Did you just think
now.
Of that?
That's really the best thoughts. Those are absolutely
She's
the best
really
thoughts.
She's really good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'll cast the dog. I'll find a good
The dog's okay, just so you know. We had to talk about that privately, my co-author Greer and I, and we're like, the
dog
is okay.
Has to be. Yeah. Do your family members, friends, loved ones worry sometimes when they read your books or read this one in particular and go, wonder where they got that
since
idea.
It's so obviously autobiographical.
Right. You know, I think what we get a lot of is like, you and Greer are, you know, kind of nice, like, but you're really sick. You know, when they read the books, like, what is wrong with you? Some of my family is here tonight. My 10-year-old son, my mom.
Hi, everybody.
A bunch of people are here.
Hi, everyone.
There. Hi, guys. They're all eating. I think it's like an actress, like an outlet, like where you can explore a character,
sure.
You can have fun with it, and then you can go back to your, you know, your ordinary life, right? So that's kind of what we do. We egg each other on. We're like, oh, that's really twisted. Keep going with that thought.
Where do you get those thoughts, though? What's the inspiration for the thoughts?
Oh, dear. Well.
the dark web?
I'm on the dark web. You know, we both studied a lot of psychology, and it's human nature. Like, we do the what if, right, 1,000 times. We do the, like, if you have the theory of, like, the infinite, you know, universes in which we all do different things, we're like, what if this character did this? What if she went this way? What if she went this way? And we take characters down different paths till we find the right one for our characters. And we kind of, we have fun being dark. And then we sort of laugh and, mm-hmm. you know, we pick up the kids from carpool and go about our day, right?
You know, I just have to say, the Hollywood casting agents can break your heart, though, because, you know, you've got all these people who would be perfect for the movie. And then, so my best example is, you mentioned Lee Child, and he's done this series of books with Jack Reacher.
Which people are very disappointed in the casting.
I went to the University of Florida, and I loved reading John D. McDonald books. He had a character, Travis McGee, and John D. McDonald was a great writer. And when I read the Lee Child series, I thought, this is very much like John D. McDonald. And Jack Reacher's kind of like Travis, and I really appreciate it. And then when they did the movie, and I love Tom Cruise. He's great in the Mission Impossible things, but he is not Jack
Reacher. No, he's not Jack Reacher.
He's
not.
Shorter.
It's like they ruined it.
This,
I can't watch those movies.
Right, yeah, I agree.
I think they said if they make another one that he's definitely out. Yeah. It was, and I love Tom Cruise too, and it just doesn't work.
But is it just that he has so much clout in that world that he could get it?
Well, they need
somebody that can sell tickets.
I knew somebody who knew the woman who did the voice for the movie the one with the
Scarlett Johansson.
Before Scarlett Johansson, there was another. It's like a voiceover artist who did the voice of the artificial intelligence, and. It was great, and she was great, and she was really excited that she got this movie part, but the studio said, you know, no, we need a name. We need Scarlett Johansson.
Never seen.
And they redubbed all of those parts with her, and so she got the money, but she didn't get the credit.
Wow. That's heartbreaking.
Yeah, it is.
Sarah, what can you tell us about the next book?
So An Anonymous Girl is out in January. We're going to be touring. We're going to be doing a bunch of stuff around here. I'll be at Politics and Prose. It's a story of a young woman who enters into a computerized study on ethics and morality. She has to answer questions such as, you see your best friend's fiancé kissing another woman a week before the wedding. Do you tell her? And so it starts out computerized, and then she gets drawn in more and more, and soon it seems as though the questioner knows a lot about her, about what she's hiding, about what she's thinking. And then it gets really creepy.
Ooh, sounds creepy.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I'm always thinking of a business for Tony in the restaurant. The Washington premiere of The Wife Between Us could be here, right? We could put a little screen up.
Yeah,
I mean, I know you have some other offers, but I'm just saying, it's out there.
Well, we should have a movie. Yeah, we should have a premiere here. A premiere.
We can put a red carpet out there.
You know what we'll do? Yeah. We'll hang a screen from Michael's across the street, and then we can all sit out.
Across the street?
Yeah, then we can all be here and watch
open
it up
air,
there.
Yeah.
All right, can we bring Fireball and wear Old Navy? Because that works for me.
Where did Fireball come from?
I don't know.
Where did this come from?
It's everywhere.
Do you know Fireball?
Is it with the drink?
Yeah.
It's liquor, right?
It's liquor that's red hot.
It's cinnamon.
It's, yeah. Okay, every generation has that drink.
Has its dreadful drink?
Yeah,
what was yours, Mark?
It was the Jägermeister. And everybody...
I think I just got a hangover by association.
Exactly.
Mine was Boone's Farm apple wine.
Yeah.
I believe I sampled it
in the back of a seat of a Volkswagen.
But that sounds classy.
And Gallo Burgundy in that huge
bottle. Yeah, that huge jug.
But I want to know the correct answer to the question. What if you see your friend kissing your fiancé?
I mean, I don't think there's any right answer. It's your own moral compass, right? I mean, we all have a different moral compass, and it depends on what yours is. So it's subjective.
I don't know.
Does that one have a happy ending?
I don't think so. I'm just guessing.
Somebody's happy.
Knowing what I know about Sarah, I don't think so.
Okay, well, let's ask. We'll get Sarah to join us in a couple of our little rundowns here. I have to talk about Michelle Obama's book. Am I the only one here at the table who's read it?
Yes.
Yes.
It's really good.
I want to read
you
something,
really
though.
Good.
I want to read you a quote from a first lady. My book, on which I built so many castles, is by the critics pronounced too near, too close to the private life of my husband. And I thought this was just what was wanted. You can well imagine my great disappointment and sorrow that no one will take this book. That was Julia Grant, wife
That's
of
incredible.
Ulysses S. Grant. And you know who helped her write the book?
Her husband?
No, because I think he was better at other stuff like drinking and battling. No, some guy named Mark Twain and couldn't find a publisher for it. How times have changed.
That's incredible. Wow. Let's go find it and sell it.
That would be a great, great thing
to read. The first two lines, I thought it was going to be the book that was thinly veiled on Laura Bush. It was by Curtis Sittenfeld.
Right, right.
Wonderful book, yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Wow. But yeah, can you believe that? And I mean, how much money up front did Michelle Obama get? And now you've read
how
it. Is it worth it?
I'm two-thirds of the way through. It's totally worth it. And I'm one of these people from Washington who never reads Washington books.
I never read Washington books.
Well, you don't need to.
Because
you read the excerpts, you see the coverage, you go,
right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Okay,
but she's
I've read
such
the good
a
stuff.
Remarkable person.
It's very real. She is remarkably transparent about her feelings as a child, growing up, the way she feels now about things. And often the titles really don't make any sense or don't really matter. But Becoming, you get the sense she really, it was a lot about what was she becoming as a person. She's growing up in the South Side of Chicago, but then she goes to Princeton and the advantages she had, but she wanted to keep the roots in her family and where they came from. And you get the sense that she feels, I don't want to put words in her mouth, but she feels as though she's still evolving as a person. But very well written, very careful use of words. So often, people from Washington at these levels write books, and every sentence is tortured because they're thinking defensively.
And 12 lawyers have gone through it.
Right.
Yeah.
So what you're saying is you had a really great editor. Is that
I
what
think
you're
so.
Thank
and
you.
It
always
comes
back
to
the editor.
They do exist.
Yeah.
Well, what about Bill Clinton and James Patterson teaming up? Have you guys talked about that?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
For this
I read it.
Yeah,
and
I read part of it.
It was not worth reading.
No.
No, it was not worth reading.
I feel like he had an
agenda.
It was
very speechy.
Yeah.
It's very speechifying.
Yes, it was.
When two people team up to write a book, it doesn't
work.
Oh, wait
work.
A minute. Never mind.
Wait a minute.
They went on the road together with interviews. That didn't work either.
Yeah, no.
But when I was looking at First Lady's books, and I, of course, go to Amazon or just Google books about First Ladies, a few dozen about Nancy Reagan. A couple she did, but then a few dozen about her, including one by her astrologer. And I had completely forgotten that she had an astrologer.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's so spectacular that she had an astrologer.
Rasputin-like figure
in
the White House.
Lady Bird Johnson, one or two, but lots of books about what she did in terms of promoting wildflowers and conservation matters in general, which was really, really sweet. And then the absolute best book ever on First Ladies, I believe, and I hope we have her on sometime, is Cokie Roberts' book, was The Founding Wives. And it's just remarkable. And she got a lot of original correspondence from the wives of the founding fathers and wrote this fantastic
that would be very
book.
Cool.
And they had a tremendous influence on what their husbands did. They never got any credit for
especially
it.
Especially Abigail Adams.
Yeah. But a lot of them. And she somehow Cokie found access to information about and then a little bit of correspondence left from Martha Washington. Martha Washington destroyed a lot of her correspondence to her husband. She sent a lot, like, get your happy ass back. You've been gone for too long.
Yeah. And this farm is falling apart without you.
Pick up some milk on the way back.
Yeah. Enough war, buddy. Come here.
Right.
But it's really pretty remarkable. Definitely worth reading. Love that book. Okay, then the other thing we have to talk about is, and now we'll be able to bring you back, Sarah, and talk about this, books that have been made into movies. Yeah. Who did it best? Who did it best?
Gosh. Who did it best?
Well, I would like to nominate All the President's Men. I mean, that's close to my heart, having worked at the
Washington
Post.
I think if everything else in life went away, you'd be happy if All the President's Men was still left.
I mean,
like buildings could fall.
Alan Pakula, Robert Redford, Dustin Hoffman, and William Goldman wrote the screenplay, which was under attack during that process.
Right.
It was under attack by Carl Bernstein and Nora Ephron, who thought they could do better. It was under attack by a lot of other people. Under attack partly by Robert Redford, who's the one who bought the rights to All the President's Men.
Uh-huh.
But I think that in the end, Pakula won, Goldman won, I think Bakula won for Best Director. I know Goldman won for Best Screenplay.
Right.
And Dustin Hoffman won for Best Actor. I think Jason Robards for
Best Supporting.
Best Supporting. So, one is close to my heart.
I just can never get back that all the President's Men made rock stars out of journalists. And I think that was the beginning of the end.
You made that point that you think that was sort of a watershed moment.
So, trivia question about the movie. What was the famous line in the movie?
Follow the money.
That wasn't actually said.
It became the catchphrase, didn't it? Yeah.
It's actually a good rule of life. It really is.
Yeah.
That's what my husband says about my checks.
Is that what I've been doing
all the time?
I also read that Redford wanted Al Pacino for the Dustin Hoffman part. Uh-huh. And then all of a sudden stepped back and thought,
We got into a big fight over Thanksgiving with our friends about To Kill a Mockingbird, whether the book or the movie was better. Both pretty spectacular.
Yeah, they're both pretty good.
And usually whatever I've done first, then I don't like, if I saw the movie first, then I don't like the book as much, or vice versa.
And now it's going to be a Broadway play.
Yes, it is. Wow. With Aaron Sorkin doing the writing and Jeff Daniels producing.
Oh, that's
going to
be good then.
Right.
That rapid-fire dialogue that Sorkin does, that'll be interesting.
You mentioned something in your show prep email, and you mentioned The Godfather, which The Godfather, to me, is one of the greatest, if not the greatest movie of all time, one and two.
Guys
not
just
three.
Talk to each other in Godfather speak.
Wait, completely.
Exactly.
But I've never read the book.
Well, you know what?
Because I love the movie so much.
The movie is better than the book.
I think so, too.
So they made it? Yeah. Wow, yeah. Really? Yeah.
Yes. Because in the book, there's all these tangents and subplots. And in a way, it's like All the President's Men. All the President's Men focuses on the first half of that book.
Right.
It throws out like the last 5 months that Woodward and Bernstein covered, you know, with the resolution of Nixon resigning, et cetera. It closes with Nixon being reelected. And Godfather does the same thing. It just pares down.
I think also the movies have become so iconic in popular culture. Yeah. Right? They just supersede all else. Pretty remarkable. I can still watch them. I can absolutely still watch them.
I can definitely watch them. In fact, I might watch them tonight.
I would say another movie I'd like to nominate, No Country for Old Men.
Mm-hmm. Oh, spectacular.
Yeah, which I think the movie's better.
Yeah.
You can still watch that movie and be horrified every step of
even
the way.
Even though you know what's gonna happen.
When Javier Bardem walks down that hallway.
Not so long ago, I watched The Shining, and that caused me to go back and read the book.
Yeah.
Movie better. And it's Jack Nicholson. Jack Nicholson took it. Right, he makes it. That scene takes it.
How about when they take the book and they improve it, like in The Natural, for instance, where in the final scene in the book, he strikes out. You know, Roy Hobbs, is that his name, strikes out. But in the movie, he, you know, crashes the lights with a big home run.
Spoiler alert.
Hey, that was great. Sorry.
For those of you who haven't seen
The Natural.
If you've ever read any of Michael Lewis's books, you know, The Big Short, Money. They're brilliant books, and they've been a brilliant translation onto film.
Trivia question, who's his wife?
C.S. Lewis. No, I don't know.
I don't know.
I forget her last name. Maybe Jamie remembers. Tabitha, who was the first kind of political correspondent on MTV.
I thought Tabitha was the daughter on Bewitched.
As were many young women of that age. Okay. Now, I have an important alert listener question about this last segment, and then we'll let Sarah get out of here with one more question. But this is where we give recommendations. If you could only take one book to the either desert island, as some of us call it, or the deserted island, as it has been pointed out. Right? Desert sounds better. Claire and I were talking about
the desert
island.
Can I get that oasis without
better.
The editor opinion?
Yeah,
for
exactly.
The desert.
No, it comes with the B. Sorry. By the way, Tabitha Soren.
Tabitha Soren,
yes.
There you go.
Yes.
Okay, Tabitha Soren story. So 92, Bush Quail, ill-fated Bush Quail campaign, just a disaster from beginning to end. And the end was made 100 times worse because we were on these dreadful train rides, which the first day it always seems fun.
What's great when you're telling this, I can see you rolling back into
disaster.
Your memory of all these
disaster.
Awful moments.
The body language gets a little tenser. She's reaching for the wine.
And all year long I was saying to the campaign, well, young people will never vote for us if we don't do anything for young people. So all year long trying to get them to do things. No, wouldn't do it. So finally it's the bitter end. And so I think mostly just to get me to shut up, they said, all right, what do you want to do? And I said, well, there's this woman, Tabitha Soren, MTV, it's really cool. And they're all looking at me like, are you out of your effing mind? I said, no, she's really smart and serious, and she wants to talk about this. Ugh, all right, so they give us, you know, a half-hour slot on one of the train rides. And she It was just a nightmare. And she steps up and she's back on the train with Bush 41, God bless him. And I had prepared him for all these really thoughtful questions about where he wanted to take the country and these kinds of things, because I had spent a lot of time with her.
And she said, what's your favorite color?
No. Yeah. She said, how come you don't pay taxes on your house in Kennebunkport?
Wow.
And that's about what we heard for the next 5 minutes. Awful. But anyhow, he's brilliant. Absolutely brilliant.
Yes.
Okay. So, Mark, desert or deserted island?
Oh, deserted island. Actually, this is good because we're talking about books that were turned into a movie. And I'm going to go with Patrick O'Brien in Master and Commander.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
And now...
Mm-hmm. My cousin Brian reads those books again and again and again. Yeah.
They are... The whole series, and I'm looking at it, I think is 20 legitimate and then one unfinished books in this series. And... When Master and Commander, it was not, the movie was not the book. They combined like several different books and mixed it together. It was still visually great, and I love seeing it on screen, but it doesn't do the books justice. It was, one of my favorite series, and I've read it twice, and I will probably read it at least twice more in my life.
What is it that causes you, seriously, Brian reads those books several times. What causes you to go back on those books?
It's great study.
Is it the knot tying? Is it the ruffling of the sails?
It's a study in leadership, you know, and it's, I love that, you know, uh-huh. And I love history, and I, you know, so for me, and I love that particular period of history, uh-huh. Almost more than any other. So I love to see the granular stuff about, and his relationship with Stephen Maturin, Jack Aubrey, and it's their rise, and it's a really... For the people that love Jane Austen, to get that sort of granular, how was life back in sort of the 1800s, right. You know, late 1700s, early 1800s, this is another slice of that kind of life. And nice. So that's to me, I can't get enough of it.
You know, it's kind of crazy because when you get to my advanced age, you realize there are only
49.
X number of books you can read, you know, realistically.
Oh, Dick.
So the idea that you would go back and read a book that you've already read and then read it again and then read it again. There are books I've read 3 or 4 times, and obviously I'm excluding books I should be reading, but they're just, it's the pure joy of it.
Yeah, if there's something you love, there's a couple of books I've read like 18 times, you know, and I can't get enough of it.
So my dad, God bless him, who's going to turn 97 next week.
Wow.
Has
Happy
read
birthday.
9 gazillion books, right? Wow. Gazillion books. And I send him books all the time, and he's like right through them. And I talked to him not too long ago. Hey, what's up? What are you reading? Oh, the Encyclopedia Britannica. I said, what? And he says, yeah. He goes, well, I've run out of everything else. And I said, well, how's it going? I'm up to O. And he's literally, he started at the beginning, and he's working his way through, and he finds it absolutely fascinating.
Ottoman Empire.
Exactly. Okay, Mark's is a good segue to mine. And later this week, we're going to end with Sarah, because she'll have some brilliant recommendation. Later this week, Jamie and I are going to go to a wonderful dinner downtown, the William Webster Dinner, which is honoring Admiral McRaven. And Jamie.
He's so McRaven.
Tell us what McRaven is most famous for, and then I'll talk about his book.
He is the Special Operations Commander who commanded the raid that got Osama bin Laden.
That's right.
Wow.
In May of, 2011.
Right? And it was really, that operation was the culmination of decades of work he did, study he did, research he did to develop really the special ops.
You know,
of
people
the
say, well, you know,
like
it's one man, how hard can it be to find? Well, just ask Pancho Villa. He ran around
Southwest
Mexico for a long time.
If you really
it's very, very, it was a meticulous operation.
Yeah.
And, you know, and people think, well, it was, you know, it was a sure thing, you know, once we knew where he was, but we didn't actually know where he was.
Yeah.
And there were so many things that could and might have gone wrong. In fact, some things did go wrong. One of the special operations Black Hawk helicopters
crashed. It could have been like a Black Hawk down.
It could have been. Yeah. And it just goes to show you how sometimes... You know, you can't judge the quality of a decision by the outcome because sometimes you have all the best information, you make the best decision, it doesn't work out. Other times you just take a gamble and it works.
Yeah.
That was a gamble.
So he has a wonderful book called Make Your Bed. The full
title.
I've read
that.
I never knew this, but Make Your Bed, Little Things That Can Change Your Life and Maybe the World.
I've read that, yeah.
And it was based on a commencement speech.
I've read that quote.
And it really was about leadership and everything he's learned about leadership, but the essence of Make Your Bed was, you make your bed in the morning, which I have always done for a long, 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 long time. It's when I first knew that Brian and I would get along, because at some early stage in our whatever, I said, I have to make my bed every morning. And even though I know he hates to make the bed in the morning, he will make the bed in the morning. But the essence of it is, you do that, then you've accomplished something.
It's a great
and
speech.
If you accomplish something, Google that speech and get the book. It's a great gift book. It's a great graduation book. Those kinds of things.
It was a graduation speech.
Yeah, Jamie.
What book
Desert or
read?
Deserted Island?
So I was going to say Known or Unknown, the Rumsfeld book.
That's a good book.
It's got too many footnotes.
It's a good book.
Stuff,
I'm in it. Calling you know him the book, a cold heartless
You mentioned
SOB.
John Grisham, and I was thinking, you know, the my there's a couple of great book John Grisham books, but I really like Playing for Pizza. Have you ever read Playing for
we
Pizza?
We talked about that in one of these shows when you're on. That's the greatest John Grisham
That's
book.
That's a great
can,
book.
Can I?
I also like The Painted House.
Can I offer a counter opinion to Playing for Pizza? Oh my God, I tried to read it. I just found it horrible.
Because it's nice and sweet people.
It's too
nice.
Predictable.
Can I just say you're wrong?
Yeah. That's not.
I don't want to be harsh about it.
You're totally entitled to say that. But at your recommendation, Jamie, I read it and I was like, what? Are you kidding me?
Wow, you're tough.
Yeah, I am tough.
All right, so what are you taking to the desert island?
All right, so I'm for fiction, okay? I need a little more fiction in my life. And there's a particular author and a particular book of hers that I like, and that is The Color of Lightning by Paulette Giles. And it is about a freed slave in 1863 who leaves Kentucky and with his family heads to the Texas Panhandle to start a new life, and then finds himself fleeing racist wives into a world of hostile Indians. And it is a book that is so rich with detail about life in Texas and the landscape in Texas during that time. And it's based on a historical character who sets up a frontier home and then has his wife and children, while he's away, raided by Indians. But it is a book that is sympathetic to every culture involved. It's sympathetic to the freed slave, it's sympathetic to the Native Americans, it's sympathetic to the whites who are trying to solve this problem. And it is a gripping, gripping story, and it's one that I wish were made into a movie. The Color of Lightning.
Maybe it will if they listen to this show.
I'm sure they will. You could only take one book.
It can't be any of your own. We know.
I have like 12 things to say based on our prior conversation, including when you mentioned 41. I was a waitress at Rio Grande when he came in and waited on the table next to him. He ordered quail. He ordered the grilled quail, which we all thought was hilarious, given the name of his vice president.
Right.
The nicest man, the nicest man in the world.
Just about the taxes in Kennebunkport?
That wasn't really on my mind. It was more like, which one of you is giving me the tip? Hold on. I've been torn between something that's going to make me sound really smart and the truth for my Deserted Island book. But I think, In Cold Blood is a really special book for me.
So good.
And a good movie.
Yeah, and a good movie because for me it was like the bridge between fiction and nonfiction. Maybe, Capote wasn't the first one to do this, but it really informed the way I approached storytelling when I went to the Baltimore Sun and the details he got. Like that serial killer whose name was Perry Smith, who had the, photographic memory and could recall every detail, and you could walk through an actual nonfiction, real-life story of this family that was murdered. And it read like fiction. I've read that book maybe 5-6 times, and I need to go back and read it again. So I would pick that.
I read that book when I was maybe 12 or 13 years old and in some hotel room with my parents. I don't know where, because we didn't go many places. So it's like a Holiday Inn Express.
Most ones,
somewhere.
They just like put a Bible or sometimes they put the Book of Mormon if you're at the Marriott. But
mine, it was in
not
cold
usually
blood.
Cold Blood.
And I don't know where my parents were, but they left me in this hotel room alone. I was reading that book and I was so terrified. I was locking doors, moving furniture. I was convinced. That's an incredible book. I'm going to go back and read that one now. Yeah. That's a fantastic
one. Really good. It holds
fantastic
up well.
Fantastic one. Mm-hmm. Right. Sarah, we are thrilled to have you here, but we got to do something. How are you going to decide which of our lucky friends out there in the restaurant gets the copy of Anonymous, which no one else has, and we have a lovely $100 gift card.
$100?
$100. They have to come back for chatter. They have to come back to chatter and spend it. It's not like an American
Express
card.
No. They're right. Yeah. They can't just go crazy. I don't know. Should we just randomly go around and spin or maybe a number?
We'll have people put numbers in a hat.
Maybe we could say somebody wearing red. I don't know. Yeah. We can have a little fun with them.
We'll do that. Someone wearing an Ohio State hat?
Oh, please.
I wore this for you tonight, Tori.
Talk about depressing things that happened over the weekend. It's karma. Wait a minute. This is important. This is a lesson in karma. So a few weeks ago, our youngest son, Charlie, goes to Michigan, sir. And I came in for a couple days just raving about the only thing better than watching your team beat Penn State is watching your team humiliate Penn State. And I pretty much trounced around town with my Michigan sweatshirt for 3 or 4 days, how great it was to just beat the crap out of Penn State. And then this past weekend, that school in the South,
Ohio State University,
embarrassed Michigan. Charlie went into his room, didn't come out for 2 days.
I'm sure.
It was terrible.
I'm sure.
Okay, Mark, get us out of here, honey.
Hey, we'll see you guys next week. Thank you. I hope everyone had a great Thanksgiving. Come back next Monday. Who's our guest?
If you love them, give me credit. If you don't love them, it's David Aldridge's credit. It's Reverend Mark Schaefer from American University. He's the chaplain.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, whoa. We're getting a response.
We love Reverend
Mark
Schaefer.
Okay, come back next week. Come back for Mark Schaefer, who seems like a really lovely guy. I met him here a couple of times.
Mark is a lovely guy. I've known him for a long time. He's a really good guy.
Yeah, he's the author of a, I think, really interesting, clearly above my head book called The Certainty of Uncertainty. And it's about the role and the influence uncertainty has in our lives and what we're seeking.
Sounds very metaphysical.
Yeah, I hope you're going to be here, Jeannie, because I won't understand any of it. Thanks, everybody.
Be here early. We'll start taping at 5:30. You need to be here at least at 4 to start drinking.
Exactly.
Here at Chatter on the
Rose
corner.
Rosé will be rolling.
On the corner of Wisconsin and Jennifer Street. We'll see you next time.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.